Okay. So, first of all, when Moshe sends the scouts to gather intel, so most of his questions seem pretty militarily suitable. I need to know the types of cities you live in. I need to know how high the walls are. I need to know how strong the fortresses are. We need to know what type of food is available, not just to be able to plan our conquest of the land, but also your military battle. You have to access food. You have food supplies like we have today, where you can just you've got to have local food supplies. So all the questions Moshe asks are context appropriate. But one of the questions he poses is a little bit strange. Hayesh ba'etzim ayin, are the trees. Moshe wants to go camping. Why would they need trees? So at some level, trees were necessary for manufacturing weapons of war, ramparts and bulwarks and tall walls. They actually built scaffolding, portable scaffolding that would be moved along wheels right along the walls, and that would allow the soldiers to climb up. So the trees were necessary to build ad hoc instruments of war and instruments of invasion. But Rashi says there's a different reason that Moshe is a tree lover. Moshe is so concerned with the trees. The trees here are metaphoric. He doesn't refer to trees. He refers to tzaddikim, righteous people. We don't really live in the shelter of trees that much because we live in inside locations. And when we spend time outside, it's typically in man-built shaded areas. So we don't really use trees for shade. But trees really provide shade, and they have much more context with trees. When David HaMelech says, he's obviously referring to the value of a tree along the banks of the river. So Moshe Rabbeinu is asking, I also want you to scout out whether their leadership is righteous. If their leadership is righteous, they'll provide shade. They'll cover them. They'll protect them in the same way that a tree provides shade and protects. So first of all, Moshe is sending an important message, which they obviously didn't register. This is not a military war. This is a supernatural war. This war won't be won or lost based on how high the walls are. This war will be won or lost based on merit, based on spirituality, based on philos, based on nivua. So unfortunately, they didn't get this message. They didn't get the memo. That's not just an issue of how high the walls are, but whether they've got tzaddikim that will warrant HaKadosh Baruch Hu's protection and delaying Am Yisrael's advance into Eretz Yisrael, even though HaKadosh Baruch Hu, see, we see it from the vantage point of Jewish history. We had been promised this land, hundreds of years of promises, Yitzias Mitzrayim. Yeah, but Hashem has a broader calculus, and if there are righteous people currently living in Eretz Yisrael, and they have certain merits, then it's hard to, it's part of what we're facing now. We're not facing a heathen culture. We're not facing in Eretz Yisrael today a pagan culture. We're facing a Islamic monotheistic culture. We're facing a culture that has a schus of bris milah and bris milah, although that not commanded in the classic sense, but bris milah, we gain Eretz Yisrael, and those who practice bris milah still have hold in Eretz Yisrael. So it's not a simple equation. When Am Yisrael is ready, we just walk into Eretz Yisrael. There's a separate part to that ledger, and that's the merits of those that are currently living there. And Moshe says, maybe we're not. What would have happened if they had reported that there weren't tzaddikim? Then possibly Jewish history would have been delayed, or possibly there would have. So there's a lot to this Rashi. Number one, he's informing the Meraglim, don't get worried if their walls are too high. No walls are too high for HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's a joke. Second of all, maybe there are some righteous people. Now, unfortunately, the Meraglim didn't get that point. They didn't understand it. The two people who did get it were Yeshua and Kalev, and that's why, in general, they had this sense of that we can cover our tzmorah, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu can allow us. But when they actually bring their reports, they say, "Ach Vashem al timrodu, don't rebel against Hashem. V'atem al tiru, don't be frightened. Kisar tzilam, their shade has disappeared. Kisar tzilam." What does Rashi say? Sar tzilam. They're referring specifically to this point because Eov was a particularly righteous person. And at least according to Rashi, Eov lived during this period. It's very hard to date Eov. I don't think to go out on a date, but to schedule when Eov lived. The Worm of Abasra has a whole machlokus when he lived. Most popularly, B'mei Shavuot HaShoftim. But there's some opinions, he's actually living during this period. He's one of Paro's advisors during the great conspiracy to subjugate the Jews. So the reporting, Eov had just died. When Eov would die, presumably it was a well-known event. He was a famous, almost infamous sufferer. So when he would die, in addition to the fact he was a righteous person, he was a well-known person, his death was well reported, was well documented. So they said, Eov has died, Yisar Tzilam, their tree, their shade, has disappeared. So the Meraglim didn't understand the supernatural nature of the war. Yoshua and Kalev did understand. Okay? So the question of Yesh Ba'etz is not just inquiring about fruit or wood or weapons for war, but conveying the sense, A, that it's a supernatural battle, B, that if there are merits, then maybe we can't enter Israel immediately or as fully as we'd like to, and C, of course, in a broader sense, that's the role of a righteous person, is to try to cover and provide shade for those who aren't as righteous. Again, I go back to David HaMelech. We sometimes have more of a egalitarian view for each zone, and each person gets judged by their own behavior. A righteous person provides that shade. A righteous person provides that coverage. And even though other people, Rav Amital would always tell us, when we daven in Elul, we're not just davening for ourselves, we're davening for all the millions of Jews that don't daven during Elul, that don't understand what Chodesh Elul is. So if you really feel that you want to be a righteous person, you want to be an Eved Hashem, you want to be B'nai Levi, as the Rambam says, so it's not just about improving your own Avodas Hashem, but realizing that your Avodas Hashem is meant to cover, as shade would cover, for those who aren't able to. So that's an interesting team of Rashis. Hayesh Ba'etz, and then when the Meraglim report, they say Tsar Tzilam. Their coverage, their shade, has vanished. Okay. Second Rashi. When this all panic and mob and fomenting reaches its apex, all of a sudden they're crying, they're screaming, and they come up with a ridiculous, ridiculous idea, at least according to Rashi. Vayamru ish el achiv nitna rosh v'nashuva mitzrayma. Let's appoint a new head, a new melech, because we disagree with Moshe's plan. Okay, that makes sense. Moshe's plan seems to be destined for disaster. So let's appoint a new king who's got a different plan. But Rashi says, Nitna Rosh, quotes Chazal, based on the Gemara and Sanhedrin, they said, let's start worshiping Avodah Zarah. This has much more sinister connotations. But this becomes more Egel-like. That it wasn't just geographic and entering Israel, not entering Israel, but now they're in Egel territory. Nitna Rosh, let's worship Avodah Zarah. How did they get to Avodah Zarah? The Parsha and Chazal in Parsha's Ketisa take such labor, so hard to explain why they fell into Avodah Zarah. The famous Kuzari, they weren't worshiping idols, they were just trying to create some physical representation of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. How did all of a sudden they arrive at Avodah Zarah here? Why is Nitna Rosh and the Shiva Mitzrayma? They're facing a hard challenge. They may panic. They may slander Eretz Yisrael. They may back down from challenges. But how does that lead to theological confusion? I think the answer is the difference between monotheism and Avodah Zarah is particularly that. Who's in control? Who sets the terms? Who sets the conditions? Monotheism is based on a hierarchy. Hashemayim Shemayim Lashem, Baruch Atzal of the Adam, Kodesh Baruch Hu determines and dictates. You face and accept his commandments. And sometimes those push you beyond human limits. Kodesh Baruch Hu is directing us to Eretz Yisrael. It seems to be a superhuman Herculean effort to destroy, to conquer all these giants, to conquer all these cities, to wage war. But monotheism is accepting and raising the bar and facing challenges that you trust that a higher transcendent being can assist you with. The whole experience of Avodah Zarah is very different. Who's in charge of Avodah Zarah? Basar Vadam. You fashion Avodah Zarah. You bribe Avodah Zarah. Even though the pagan gods have more strength than you, you're still in charge because you can bribe them, you can pray to them, you can trigger them, you can... So here they're facing a superhuman challenge and they're frightened. So they want to switch roots of religion. They want to switch models of religion to a religion they can control. Let's build a religion, we'll fashion our own gods, we'll fashion these idols, and we'll set the terms. We'll decide which country to conquer. We'll decide, rather than being challenged to some transcendent country that's the king, the land of God, the land of some celestial being, and we're forced to battle on behalf of it, let's just reset and reboot the terms of our religion to create a pagan god that we're in control of. In Parshas Ki Tetzeh, where Yifas Tohar is taken from her home and integrated into the Jewish home, she's given a month to cry. Why is she given a month to cry? So the simple reason is she misses her parents, she misses her family. Rashi says she misses her Avodah Zarah. Why does she miss her Avodah Zarah? Because it's easy. Avodah Zarah, you're in control, you're in command. Even though they're more powerful than you, you're manipulating pagan gods. Whereas in monotheistic God, you're on the receiving end of commands, challenges that sometimes seem very imposing in religion, and in this case historically, and they're not equipped for that. They're not equipped to face these types of challenges. Okay. Finally, one of the most fascinating words of the entire Parsha on many levels, and a fascinating Rashi. When the decree is handed down, history is delayed, there's a group of people who still feel it's chesed Eretz Yisrael, we want to be in Israel at all costs. They disobey Moshe, they're slaughtered on the battlefield. What are they called? The Ma'apilim. Vaya'apilu la'alos el Rosh Ahar. Very, very strange word. Doesn't appear anywhere else in the Torah. So let's break this down to the three levels of interpretation. Number one, what does it mean etymologically? Number two, what does it mean contextually? Number three, what does it mean historically? Because Pesukim undergo transformations as history unfolds. So Rashi says the word vayapilu really captures three related meanings. What's beautiful about Hebrew is that words are not as tight as they are in other languages. They spill into related meanings. So according to Rashi, there are three meanings. Two that stem from the root ayin pei lamed. One that stems from the root aleph pei lamed, which of course in Hebrew we allow letter swaps. So ayin pei lamed, according to Rashi, connotes two things. Number one, it connotes strength. Rashi quotes a pasuk, if I'm not mistaken, in Chavakuk, that you're very strong. It could be physical strength. It's probably here in this case emotional strength, maybe unhealthy emotional strength, where you're reinforcing your position against all odds, against advice from other people. Sometimes when we strengthen ourselves, we're becoming more obstinate and more inflexible. So there, vayapilu, there's a strength, but also there's a military strength that's being gathered. So the first connotation of vayapilu is strength, military or emotional. The second connotation, Rashi says, of a vayapilu is brazenness, going against advice, chutzpah, insolence. They were being advised by Moshe. This is not the time. The odds were clearly stacked against them. I don't know how many people participated in the Ma'apilim, but it clearly was a minority. So all of a sudden, the number is working against them. The timing is working against them. Moshe Rabbeinu is discouraging them. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is discouraging them. But they're going against the tide. When we take a brazen act, we're going against convention. Convention suggests X, we determine Y. Everyone's expecting A, we determine B. There's a counterintuitiveness where sometimes that's good. Sometimes it's important to be Azaz Metzach. But sometimes too much Azaz Metzach or too much self-reinforcement leads us to the third interpretation of Vayapilu. Rashi quotes the Medrash of darkness. They were working without reason, without light, without accepting people's input. They were just, sometimes when we're too hard-headed, it's called in Hebrew Rosh Bakir. We just bang our heads against the wall. We say we're right. We're not going to listen to anyone. We're not going to accept anyone's advice. All of a sudden, we operate in darkness. We operate without any clear path, without any reason, without any chances for success. So first of all, Rashi combines three meanings into the word vayapilu. It means strength, military or emotional. It means brazenness. And it means operating under conditions of darkness rather than conditions of ration. Okay, that's the first layer. To prove the second meaning in particular, Rashi quotes two psukim in Tanakh. One pasuk is from Micha. Let me read the pasuk in Yeshaya first. In Yeshaya, to prove that it means brazenness, so in Yeshaya, in Parak Lamed Beis, Yeshaya prophesizes the impending galus, and he says that everything will be ransacked and will become empty, and even the outposts will become empty. Normally outposts are staffed and manned. Hamon ir uzav, ofel vavachan. Ofel, vayapilu, vavachan. Even the outposts, the towers, haya ba'ad me'aros, will become empty like caves. And that's how desolate Israel will become. Similarly, ofel doesn't just mean a outpost, but ofel means a tower and an outpost, not just in Yeshaya, but in Micha, Perek Dalet. We'll get back to Micha in a few moments. V'yatam Migdal Eder. I live in a street called Migdal Eder, the tower of the flock. Migdal Eder. Ofel, Bat Zion. The tower, the guard post, the outpost of Bat Zion. Adecha Teaseh Uva Memshalah. And the Geula will come. He's not prophesizing doom, he's prophesizing Geula in Micha. So, that's strange, because in Micha and in Yeshaya, Ofel means a tower, an outpost. Whereas Rashi uses those psukim to suggest brazenness and Azaz Metzach. The answer is because those who serve on the outpost have to be very courageous people. You're normally by yourself. You're normally holding down the fort, literally. You're normally facing innumerable odds. You're normally the outpost that is first letting people know behind the scenes to reinforce and to redistribute the military strength. So you have to be someone of courage. You have to be someone of brazenness. You're not just a member, a rank-and-file soldier in a large army going to war. You're standing at the outpost. But what happens is, is the Torah uses that word to describe brazenness, not just Azus Metzach, to describe the actual war. Where did this war with the Mapilim take place? On the outpost. They didn't enter Eretz Yisrael. They were slaughtered before they got in. That's the tragedy. Vayapilu means that they were dealing with the outposts, as in Micha and in Habakkuk. They didn't get to Hebron. They didn't get to Yerushalayim. It's not like they had initial successes and they won the initial wars and they got to Hebron or Be'er Sheva or Beit Lechem and fought these wars and lost. They were slaughtered from the get-go. They were slaughtered at the Mapilim level. They were slaughtered at the Ophel level. So Rashi, by quoting these two psukim from Micha and Habakkuk, is not just describing their intransigence and their brazenness, but is also describing how tragic it was. They didn't get into Eretz Yisrael. They were destroyed at the level of the Mapilim, at the level of the outposts, because Ophel means an outpost. So that's the second layer. The third layer is, this is a prophetic pasuk. Psukim are not static. They don't just describe the moment. They reverberate throughout Jewish history. At what point in Jewish history does the word Mapilim all of a sudden transform into something a little bit more redemptive, successful? Anyone know what I'm talking about? Right. Mapilim was the term used to describe what was called Aliyah Bet. Aliyah Aleph was the first attempts to bring Jews under legal terms through the conditions of the very, very restrictive white paper where the British mandate government prevented that many Jews from moving to Palestine. And then primarily during the war, there were two stages to Aliyah Bet or Mapilim HaPalah. During the war to try to help people escape from Nazi Germany, in the post-World War II era, trying to get all these displaced persons to get to Israel, that was called Aliyah Bet, second stage, Aliyah Bilti Chukit, also it was an acronym. It was also called Ma'apilim. It was successful, partially. About 140 boats sailed, some of them capsized at sea, some of them were arrested in mid-flight, mid-voyage by the British Navy, probably about half of them. There's a lot of documentation. There's a former Talmud of the Yeshiva called Eric Halivni, has put together a lot of videos describing the efforts taken across the globe to try to smuggle Jews into Israel. As you know, the most famous story is the story of the Exodus ship being turned back. Many of these Jews were interred in Cyprus. Many of these Jews were interred in Atlit, which is on the beach of Eretz Israel. So at this point, Hapala becomes not people who are slaughtered, but people who are struggling to get into Eretz Israel, with moderate success. I see Mapilim as a word in process. It starts out as a nefarious word. It becomes a word that captures the struggle to move to Israel. If you have a second over Shabbos, read Micha Perek Dalet. Micha Perek Dalet captures that struggle. Gula will come, but it will be difficult. And just in the end of Micha Perek Dalet, Gula is likened to a pregnant woman who's coughing and convulsing and screaming. And so the word Hapala is used in Shlach to describe we're not ready yet, and you're facing the outpost, and you get slaughtered. But in Micha, second stage, all of a sudden it becomes a transitional process of Gula with the difficulties, and it foreshadows the years in post-World War II of the Mapilim, and hopefully at one point we'll turn into a word which just skates right through and we get into Eretz Israel, as we do today, without any struggle with returning to our homeland. So it's really important to be able to read the psukim that Rashi quotes, read them in context, and understand how they undergo historical transformation. Shabbat shalom, everyone.